hotel for the December council meeting. Just a few notes before we get started here. As you can see, Mr. Aristad is not in the room today. He will be participating remotely. Shout out to you on the in the internet world there, Eric. I mean, Peter. Eric Hansen actually will be late. He had some vessel issues, so he should be joining us later this today. Dr. Hare is actually out on the NIMS trawl survey, so we have his replacement. Dr. Simpkins will be filling in for the Science Center rep today. A few other things. Obviously, we're on Zoom webinar. Make sure everyone's logged in. If you are having issues, please contact staff, those in the internet world. If you are having issues, you can probably contact council staff, those online. Just a reminder, everyone have their microphones off. Do want to welcome a few people. Welcome back to our federal partners. I know you had a brief off time, but so you're all at the table here. Good to have you back in place. Want to welcome Mr. Alexander, our new council member from Maine, new old council member from Maine. He's actually already been sworn in, so we don't have to go through another swearing-in ceremony. So welcome back, Terry. If there are any topics for other business, obviously we'll be getting that on Thursday. Just either let I or Kate know, and we will get that on the agenda for Thursday. Just a reminder also that we are having our public comments on Thursday, so if there's any interest in participating in the public comments, please contact Alexander Dunn, and he'll get you on the list. Starting off today, I feel like I'm not close enough. Starting off today, I just got a few things on my own to report to the council. XCOM, as most of you know, met on November 13th. Dr. O'Keefe will be giving a much broader presentation on what we did during XCOM, but it was a very robust discussion, particularly around the priorities. And well, we will be talking briefly. Any priorities discussion will be mostly done on Thursday. So even as we talk through scallops and ground fish in the next couple days and dogfish and what have you, if you could just hold off on your priorities discussion for Thursday, that would be great. Just another note for NTAP, I just want to give a brief update of where we are at NTAP. As you know, at the last meeting, I gave an update that the RIBITS, the Regional Industry-Based Trawl Survey, was getting ready to go out on the water for November. Unfortunately, that did not happen due to the fact that they were not able to get the LOA. The information was submitted to GARFO. Unfortunately, they were not able to get that done in time for the government shutdown. So we rescheduled it. I think we're looking for March to get that boat back on the water for our initial phase one work. We also had to pause our working group meetings, obviously without our NOAA partners and without some information garnered from the original phase one pilot. We were not really set to have those discussions, but we are ramping those back up. Very robust agenda moving forward. We're going to be doing every 3 weeks a two-hour meeting, talking about survey design, gear, who's going to run it, you know, basically really putting the nuts and bolts to it with a lot of presentations from our Science Center folks to get them involved in it. So anyone that's interested, please be, you know, be prepared to sit in, listen in. We will take any comments during those meetings. With that, I am pretty much done with my report, and I will kick it over to Dr. O'Keefe for her executive deck report.
Morning, everyone. Welcome to Newport. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a few topics to cover today. I'll wait for the presentation to come up. Great. If you could go to the next slide, please. So starting off with a little bit of financial information, we are still operating under the three major grants that I've described over the last year. Our no-cost extension for our 2020 through 2024 cooperative agreement is almost over. That ends at the end of this month. We will be completing final reporting and closeout processes for that grant. We were able to spend that down pretty well. The available balance was just about $80,000 out of a, you know, $23 million grant. So we did a pretty good job spending that one down. We have completed the majority of the scope that was included for the no-cost extension. So closing that one out with completed deliverables and a very low balance. The IRA grant is, that deadline for completion is March 31st, 2027. We're on track with spending on that grant. Several contracts underway now. We expect to ramp up those initiatives in 2026. Several workshops are planned. We'll keep our contracts going, and so spending is on track for that grant. The real update here is on our current award, the 2025 through 2029 award. This is our you know, major source of operating funds right now. We received our full funding for fiscal year 25, which ended at the end of September. And the government shut down on October 1st. It is now open again under a continuing resolution through January 30th. So we anticipate receiving funds for this portion of fiscal year 26, October 1 through January 30th at some point. That will be flat funding from the budget levels that were set in March of 2024. There has not been an updated budget for the Department of Commerce since March of 2024 because we've had continuing resolutions since then. After that date, it's unclear where our funding will go, which direction, whether it will remain under a continuing resolution and flat funding for the remainder of fiscal year 26, or if there will be any adjustments and anticipated, if there are adjustments, they would be in the downward direction, potential decreases, but it's highly uncertain right now. We do hope to get a funding drop of this money, the October through January money, sometime very soon. NOAA hasn't received all of their allocated funds yet, and so the councils are waiting. We definitely really hope to get this money dropped before another potential shutdown at the end of January. So just to put it in perspective, you can see on the screen here, we do have an available balance moving forward. From our fiscal year 25 money. This is a surplus that we're carrying over into fiscal year 26 and into calendar year 26 of about $1.3 million. This would allow us to operate without any changes for about 3 months if we didn't get any additional funding before that time. We do really hope to get additional funding before that time and be able to apply this surplus to some of the initiatives that we'll be talking about on Thursday under 2026 work priorities. Next slide, please. So just a quick update on some interagency meetings that occurred. The Transboundary Management Guidance Committee, TMGC, met in Halifax, Nova Scotia on October 1st. The follow-up U.S.-Canada Steering Committee, which typically reviews what the TMGC has done and provides information for the following year, that was canceled. It was scheduled for October 14th. That was during the federal shutdown. There was a Council Coordination Committee, CCC, meeting scheduled for the middle of October. That was also canceled due to the federal shutdown. In lieu of that, the executive directors from all eight regions met on October 16th to cover some council business and planning for next year's initiatives. The Northeast Region Coordinating Council, NRCC, also canceled due to the federal shutdown. Discussions have already started about rescheduling that, hopefully for sometime in January. And the East Coast Coordination Group was not canceled. We held that meeting in November virtually, really focused on workshop planning for next year, 2026, around IRA initiatives and different coordinated projects between the two councils and commission. Next slide. As Dan mentioned, the executive committee met on November 13th. One of the major topics coming out of that meeting was related to the enforcement committee. In 2025, enforcement committee activities were paused. There was the retirement of the enforcement committee chair and some changing of enforcement committee representatives, and activities were paused. We did set a work priority to re-engage the enforcement committee this year. So we talked with the executive committee and they made some recommendations on how to re-establish the committee, redefine the function of it, and think about format and logistics. So the executive committee is recommending, and we will follow through after this meeting to reestablish membership. This option recommended by the executive committee is that this committee would include law enforcement representatives only. So no council members, no other members that are not recognized law enforcement officials. From NOAA Office of Law Enforcement, NOAA General Counsel, the U.S. Coast Guards, and then the Marine Enforcement representatives from each of the five New England states. Executive Committee also recommended dissolving the advisory panel. We struggled a little bit to understand the actual role of the advisory panel to the Enforcement Committee and thought it might be more appropriate to have recommendations for tasking to the Enforcement Committee come directly through the full council. And finally, in terms of format and logistics, we want to maintain at least an annual standing meeting, and then we can plan additional meetings as needed on an ad hoc basis and upon request. The Executive Committee also discussed 2026 priorities, and as the Chair mentioned, we will get into that in detail on Thursday morning. And finally, in a closed session, the Executive Committee made recommendations for advisory panel members for our new term starting January 2026 through December of 2028. We are in the process of finalizing those recommendations to make the appointments, and we will have the announcement of those members by the end of this month. Next slide. Wanted to just briefly cover some council actions and correspondence that has been submitted from our September meeting. Everybody, we were very busy, as you know, and we took final action on five separate topics. We have submitted the Management Flexibility Omnibus, Groundfish Amendment 25, SCATE 26 to 28 specifications, and Monkfish Framework 17. And we will be submitting the Essential Fish Habitat Redesignation Action very soon following this meeting. We've also submitted some comments. We did complete and finalize and submit our response to Executive Order 14276 related to seafood competitiveness based on the council feedback. We submitted the on-demand working group recommendations that were approved by the council in September to the Center and GARFO. We were requested to supply some information to Representative Magaziner from the state of Rhode Island about the status of New England fisheries. And we've submitted some comments on offshore wind monitoring standards that was presented to us back earlier in the summer with a request for feedback from the Science Center. And I believe that's all I have. I'm happy to take any questions.
Questions for Dr. O'Keefe. Jeff Smith. That would be helpful, but I'll go to you, Terry, if you have a question.
Okay, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Rookie mistake.
Anyway, I'll log on after I'm done with my question. So I chaired the Law Enforcement Committee last time I was on the council, and lack of better term, the law enforcement people have no idea how we function on the water. So how are we supposed to get any... Are we supposed to get good recommendations out of just law enforcement people? It was the interaction that was important. So,
thank you, Terry. I appreciate the feedback. The thinking behind the executive committee recommendation was that the enforcement committee has in the past struggled with the lack of ability to have a closed session to discuss confidential information around enforcement issues. By having council members present, it's very challenging to have a closed session where they can discuss those topics. So what we are hoping is that recommendations to the enforcement committee, requests to the enforcement committee for feedback would come through the full council, that we would have a pretty fleshed out request to get feedback from them. We will have a council staff member that will coordinate the committee so we can work through the staff member to ensure that council questions are directly addressed and feedback that way.
Jeff Smith.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thanks, Dr. O'Keefe, for the update. Appreciate the information on the budget situation and what you're trying to do to resolve that to the extent we can. I wanted to ask about the one of the comments we submitted in response to Representative Magaziner's request. First, thanks to you and the staff for putting together the response on that. I thought it was very well done and painted a pretty good picture of the current situation that we find ourselves in. I am curious if you know if other councils have received similar queries or have provided information to folks who are requesting it, because I do think it would be helpful for the council enterprise as a whole for similar responses to the questions Representative Magaziner asked. So any idea whether that's happening elsewhere in the country?
Yeah, thanks for the question. So actually, Representative Magaziner sent a letter to all councils through the CCC in the spring with basically the same questions. And the CCC provided a response. It came through us as the host council this year with examples of status of different aspects in different regions. I appreciate the question, though, because you know, that was in May, and it was very fresh at that point how different budget and staffing cuts in, at the agency would impact council operations. And so Representative Magaziner's question to us as a follow-up was useful in that we've had some now time to digest how this is going to impact. So I think it would be useful possibly to bring up to the CCC a follow-up as, you know, now that it's kind of taken effect and we understand the impacts better.
Yeah, thank you for that. And I was going to suggest the same, that if the CCC gets the opportunity to meet again, perhaps the whole group could do that, because I think it'd be useful. Thank you.
The CCC is scheduled to meet in May. There was some question about possibly having an interim since we lost the one in October. But I think it's going to be put on pause until May. Jackie O'Dell, then Tog Braun.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Dr. O'Keefe. Just curious on the rescheduling for the NRCC meeting, is it assumed that the agenda will be the same, or will the agenda potentially be modified? Just curious, I know you're providing a presentation later about providing an update on science and management realities moving forward, and wondering if that's something that the NRCC plans on discussing as well. Thanks.
Thanks for that question. We just had our initial email on trying to reschedule the NRCC meeting yesterday. We are looking at dates possibly for January. Originally, the meeting was set for, you know, a day and a half in person, so this would probably be more like a day virtual. So we will probably pare down the agenda, but, you know, I think across the board, the NRCC principals want to focus on the stock assessment scheduling questions. A lot of the questions that the reason we had to cancel the meeting was the federal shutdown, and we really needed information from the center. So I do think that the bulk of the agenda will focus on those more time-sensitive science-related questions.
Tog Braun, then Ted Platts.
Thank you very much. As an explanation to those in the room, I'm getting over a cold, which is why I'm sort of hiding in the corner over there. But just to follow up on what Terry had mentioned, I absolutely trust the recommendations of the executive committee in terms of how to make things, how to make the enforcement committee the most useful. I would just raise a flag that we definitely need to find a way to work collaboratively and constructively and proactively. There were some concerns about some behavior in the Northern Gulf of Maine that we sent a letter that I felt was pretty well fleshed out. And the response we got was, I would say, incredibly disappointing of, yeah, we can't do that. So if there's any way to enhance that relationship, make sure everyone feels valued and important, whether it's a liaison, maybe Terry would like to volunteer to be the liaison to that. I just want to raise the true importance of making sure that the management decisions that we make are followed through and that everyone's behaving as well as possible. So thank you.
Thank you, Tog. Ted Platts.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question on process, really. I just kind of curious as to why the executive committee is deciding on the advisors for various FMPs. It seems that you're moving the decision making away from the people that have the most knowledge about the individuals. I would see where the executive committee would be interested in specifying a number of advisors we want for, you know, financial reasons and reasons having to do with the larger picture. But, you know, and I look at Monk and Skate, for example, I look at the executive committee and I think, well, there's probably one person on there that knows the players. And so it seems like we're moving the decision-making process away from the knowledge base towards, you know, higher up. And I think there should be some input from the executive committee, but it seems like, I mean, it doesn't seem to be serving the best interest of getting the best advisors.
Thanks. Yeah. So the reason why the executive committee does the appointments, that's what is laid out in our operations handbook. That's how it's been conducted in the past. The process includes, obviously, solicitation for applications from the public, and then each committee, each actual FMP committee, has an opportunity to review the applications and make recommendations on the applicants and who would be best served. And then it's the executive committee that takes all of that compiled information and makes the final appointments. And the part of the process that we're in right now is once we have those executive committee recommendations, and now they're going through a vetting process with Office of Law Enforcement. And once we get back those results, then we will make the final appointments based on that full process from the application to the committee recommendations to the XCOM recommendations and the OLE vetting.
Follow up.
Yeah, I just, I think the fact that we're doing it because it's the way we've always done it doesn't really carry the question. The advisors and I checked the box, yes or no. That's the committee input. The advisors typically write one, two, maybe someone who's particularly verbose might write three sentences. So I don't think there's a lot of meat there for the decision to be made by people that haven't been interacting. And in Monksgate, and I'm sure it's true in a lot of other FMPs, there's specific knowledge sets that are relevant. There's regional interests. There's the way people prosecute the fishery. I just think it's not a good way to do business. And I think, as with a lot of things that I'm encountering now after 20 years of being an advisor and a year and some time on the council, the way we've always done it is probably part of the problem in the council's track record. And I'll just leave it at that. Thank you.
Dr. O'Keefe.
Thanks. And thanks for the comment. And if the council wants to change the process, then we're open to hearing new processes. This is the way we've done it. The council has the purview to change our operations handbook. The staff can't change our operations handbook on our own. So if there are new suggestions for new methods, then we're open to hearing them.
And I would just like to follow up from my perspective when we were reviewing this. The information we got, obviously we got the committee recommendations to review. I really took those to heart. What was the committee? Because as you said, the committee is more aware of these individual FMPs maybe than the executive committee as a whole. We also were included, depending on FMP and who collected the information, we actually did get other information as well, basically the discussion points that were brought to the table by the committees themselves. So there was a lot more information of just a list and a check a box of a yes or no from the committee. So I think what we were trying to come up with was based on the recommendations that actually came out of the committee. It's not like we just went off on our own and said, well, yes, no, or whatever. For the most part, I think we did rely on. I mean, when you consider that this year was actually a very tough one because we actually had for quite a few committees, FMPs, we actually had more people putting their names in than actual seats, which has been a very rare occasion for our APs in the recent past. So it was a little more tough. And I think from my perspective, I did rely on way heavily much of what came out of the committee recommendations. Any other further questions for Dr. O'Keefe? Thank you. Moving on to GARFO, Mr. Pentney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, everybody. So I have a few items. First off, you should be seeing today that the agency is reopening the comment period on the Restoring American Seafood Competitiveness responses to the executive order and suggestions for things that the agency and the councils could be pursuing to address the mandates and the ideas, concepts in that executive order. So that comment period reopened yesterday and will remain open through December 15th. So if you haven't yet submitted ideas, suggestions, you have another opportunity. If you already have submitted but you got some new ideas, please consider submitting those as well. Moving on to some of our regional actions. On November 18th, we published a temporary rule. This was 2 days after we reopened, increasing the herring area 1A sub-ACL from 783 metric tons to 1,783 metric tons. And that was to account for the 1,000 tons that are set aside pending a review of the New Brunswick Weir fishery landings. And because landings were below the threshold, we were able to move that extra quota into Area 1A. So it was effective on November 17th. The commission set landing days starting on the 24th and on the 25th. The additional quota was reached, was harvested, and so the states, through the commission process, closed the fishery. We are following suit, reducing the possession limit back down to 2,000 pounds for the rest of the calendar year. Scallop Research Set-Aside Program, I was hoping that I would have an update as to when it was publishing or that it was publishing. It is still pending final review at NOAA. So the clock is ticking, and we're starting to get very, very concerned that if it doesn't publish, you know, within minutes or days, we're not going to be able to have a research set-aside opportunity for 2026. We are exploring some potential ways to extend the Maine Department of Marine Resources Scallop RSA Dredge Survey for an additional year because of the importance of that, that project to getting survey coverage in the Gulf of Maine. Literally 5:02 p.m. on September 30th, with a closure happening in a matter of hours, we submitted the rule to extend the groundfish emergency action. So that was published on October 3rd. We were very glad we were able to get that in place, especially given how long the closure, the government shutdown lasted. So that covers the groundfish fishery under the emergency regs through the end of the calendar year. Through the end of the fishing year, April 30th, 2026, Framework 69 is still pending, the proposed rule for that. So hopefully we'll see some progress on getting the proposed rule for Framework 69 out. And then once the comment period closes, we can try to get the final rule, hopefully quicker than the proposed rule has been going. That's all I really have on fishery management actions, but I do want to update the council. I think I may have mentioned this in September as well, but just to remind everybody that back in July, we received a petition from the Center for Biological Diversity to list cusk as threatened or endangered under the Endangered Species Act. They also asked us to designate a critical habitat. So we are reviewing that petition to determine whether the petition presents substantial scientific or commercial information indicating that the petitioned action may be warranted. So again, just to kind of refresh everybody, this does not mean that we would conclude whether a listing is warranted, but whether simply a status review is warranted. So if we determine that the petition does not have substantial information indicating that a listing may be warranted, we would deny, essentially do a negative, what we call a negative 90-day finding, and that ends the process. If, however, there is some merit to, potential merit to the petition, then we would do a positive 90-day finding, and that would initiate a year-long process to do a status review. At which point we would be soliciting additional information from the public, the states, the fishing industry, and others that we would take into account during our status review. The conclusion of the status review would be a decision whether or not to list the species as endangered or threatened under the ESA. So we're at the first step, but it is something, given that cusk is encountered both in the commercial fishery and the recreational fisheries in New England, it is something, I think, for the council to be paying attention to and thinking about in terms of management measures that might address cusk that we would then be able to consider in our review. And I think that's all I have for now, Mr. Chairman, so I'll stop and see if there's any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Pitt. Any questions? Jackie O'Dell?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mike, for the update. First, I just wanted to thank you and your staff and the folks in D.C. for mobilizing quickly and renewing the emergency action for groundfish prior to the shutdown. I know that your staff did a lot to make sure that that was in place before the shutdown. So thank you for that. But I have a quick comment I want to make is, you know, we're already at 50% of Gulf of Maine haddock right now for the catch for this fishing year. And, you know, the behavior in the fishing industry and the opportunities for fishing have been very limited. You know, that assessment was done in 2024, and it would have been better to probably have an emergency action that wasn't looking at the rollover specs, but something that actually followed that. Because right now in the fishery, there's just a lot of constraints, a lot of folks not knowing when Framework 69 is going to go forward. So the availability of quota is extremely limited. Prices are fluctuating. It's just the behavior and the opportunities for fishing have been restricted, and it doesn't need to be that way. So just wanted to make that note. And anything that we can do to help with Framework 69, I know your staff, again, has worked very hard and submitted that over the summer, and it went into a black hole in D.C., and it's kind of confusing exactly what's occurring down there and where what reviews need to take place. But anything that the council can do to help that process, if you feel that it's going to get delayed again, please feel free to reach out, because it's unfortunate that that hasn't been approved yet. Thanks.
John Pappalardo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mike, the petition for CUSC seems to be, in my head, I feel like this has been a target of a petition for listing in the past. Is that right? I know Wolfish was at one point, but I think CUSC was a target too.
I'm not sure. I mean, I'd have to go back and check with our protected resources staff, but I know that there was a point in time when we started to prepare a status review. And I don't know if that was in response to a petition or just rumblings of a petition. And then I think it's possible that we started to put together the materials for a status review, anticipating a petition. We never got one formally, and so we stopped. So, I mean, that's what I've heard from staff. So I think you're right that there was a petition, or there was talk of a petition for Wolfish and maybe CUSC as well, and those ended up not coming through formally, so we didn't really move on those.
Now, I appreciate you raising the issue again. I do remember you bringing it up. I think it was in June. And you're asking the council to pay attention. Just, you know, we're going to do priority discussion on Thursday, and I have the honor of chairing the Groundfish Committee. just wondering if there's specific things you think we could do to be best prepared to deal with it. You don't have to answer now, but...
I think that's a great question, and I think it is something Kate and I had the conversation before the shutdown. We had hoped to make a little bit more progress on, you know, the potential outcome of the 90-day review, to give input to the council before it, you know, completed its priority setting for 2026. But I guess I would just suggest to the Groundfish Committee, you know, knowing that there is concern about the status of this resource, looking at the management opportunities and seeing if there are opportunities to, you know, to constrain catch or gather information about catch and you know, to contribute to the process. I think that would be helpful in the long term.
If there is a need to do something, it's determined that we have to do something. What's the timeline? What are the requirements to act?
So, yeah, I mean, the first step would be, as I said, the 90-day finding. If that's a positive finding, meaning that we think there is some merit to the proposal, then, or to the petition, then we would do a status review, which typically is around 12 months, just for the status review, the conclusion of which is the listing determination, which usually, I'm pretty sure it goes through proposed and final rulemaking for listing. And then we, you know, part of that process would be to do biological opinions for the fisheries that are potentially encountering CUSC, and then developing reasonable, prudent alternatives or measures to reduce, you know, the catch of the impact of the fisheries on CUSC. So it can be an extended process, but, you know, in practice, one of the pieces of the status review are things like what other management controls are already in place. And if there are none, then that sort of points us in one direction in terms of the status review. If there are management controls in place, then that allows us, gives us something to evaluate whether those are in fact strong enough, and, you know, or whether more are needed.
Terry Alexander.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. Mike, I was asked to ask you if there's any update on the status of the small mesh fluke exemption from the Mid-Atlantic.
Yeah, so the comment period on that ended during the shutdown, but we, you know, have picked that back up in preparing the package for implementing the final action. We had been trying to get the final rule out before November 1st when the season opened, the exemption area opened. That obviously didn't happen, but we have a little bit of time before it ends this year, so we're trying to get that done so that it is available at least for part of the fishing year.
Jeff Kalin, online.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Council. Jeff Kalin with Lunds Fisheries. Mike, that at the risk of feeling like I'm piling on, I have to ask about the herring specs too, which we all know have been delayed, and I know you've been doing what you can to get those finalized. But I did want to get that question on the record, so. Thanks for your efforts, but obviously we'd love to have that quota extended after the first of the year. We're not going to be able to do that likely, but I wanted to ask about herring. So thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. Yeah, at this point, we don't have a publication date or clearance to publish the final rule. It has been held up since August, along with another number of actions. We really hope that it can shake loose and publish before we have to do the rollover specs for January 1st, because it would be really unfortunate if fishery is, you know, I would say unduly constrained come January under the old 2025 specs. And so we're really hoping we can get something published so that the rollover will be the new specs. But I just can't promise anything.
No, I understand. We appreciate your efforts, so that would be great if that could happen. Thanks again.
Dr. O'Keefe.
Thank you. I just wanted to note that the Council and Commission submitted a joint letter just last week to Secretary Lutnick requesting implementation of those specifications as soon as possible. So I just wanted to note that we did send that letter last week.
Well, that I didn't know, even though I'm on the herring board over there. So that's great to hear, Kate. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Penney. Up next is NOAA General Counsel, Attorney McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Relatively short report this time. One substantive update and then two relatively small procedural updates. The substantive update involves the case I discussed last meeting of Cape Cod Charter Boat Association versus the ASMFC. It was a challenge to Addendum 2 to this striped bass program that was implemented in 2024, and the court addressed a motion to dismiss that was filed by the government and granted that motion to dismiss. It was based on primarily the complaint not showing the injury to the plaintiffs and a way for the court to redress that injury to give them relief that they were seeking. And so that the court dismissed the case without prejudice. The plaintiffs could file a new complaint with allegations that meet the standards to show an injury and that the court can provide the relief that they seek. But at this point, the case is dismissed. Two other cases, the NEFSA case that's challenging Framework 65 and the council system and the authority of council members, whether it complies with the Constitution. That case, you may recall, is in the briefing stages. NEFSA filed their original brief. The government filed its brief on, I'm sorry, that was in May. The government filed its brief in August. NEFSA filed a response and reply on November 3rd. And the government's brief is due next Friday in that case. And that's currently before the First Circuit Court of Appeals. The other case is the Relentless case that was in the District of Rhode Island and now is in the First Circuit as well. The appellant's brief is due on January 16th. And that's it.
Questions for Attorney McDonald? Seeing none, thank you. Moving on to Dr. Simpkins with the Science Center update.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I've met many of you in the past, but some are new faces for me here. So I'm the Resource Evaluation and Assessment Division Director at the Northeast Fisheries Science Center. Been in that role for a decade or so now, so that's why I've met some of you. That group, my division includes the Population Dynamics Branch that does the stock assessments you're familiar with, the Social Science Branch that provides economic and human dimension support for management actions in addition to research and other things, and the Ecosystem Dynamics Assessment Branch that, among other things, produces the State of the Ecosystem Report. So my group does stuff that you've seen. John Hare, as was mentioned before, sends his regrets. He's on leg 4 of the bottom trawl survey, which I guess is an indicator of the importance of that survey to the center, both that we got a leg 4 approved and that he's going on it. As has been stated, you know, obviously the recent months have been unusual in terms of, you know, 6 weeks furlough for almost all our staff, but we still have quite a bit to share, which is good news, I think. We've succeeded in carrying out a lot of critical work, a lot of data collection work, providing some critical products through hard work of our staff before, during, and after the furlough, and with close coordination with council and GARFO staff has been really critical. I know John is, and I am very proud of the work of our staff during this unusual time, and we're hoping that what we've been able to provide through this time has been helpful to you all. So budget, as Kate noted, like the council, we're currently operating on a CR through January, and we are also still waiting for funds to arrive. So that's challenging. Surveys, so all of our surveys were able to run through the government shutdown, which I think that's the first time we succeeded in doing that. That was quite a feat and required a lot of work and required support from NOAA and Commerce above. So it's a good sign that we had that support. Looking for the silver lining and all these things. So the bottom trawl survey, the originally planned 3 legs ran from September 5th to November 13th. They completed 234 of their 377 planned stations. They worked to try to make sure they had the survey coverage, so they got at least one station sampled in 90 of the 91 substrata. But obviously some strata were sparsely covered. That was part of the justification that John Hare and others went forward to get support for adding a 4th leg, which is out now, to sort of complete that spatial coverage and increase the station density. So we're hoping for good weather for that. Looking to the future for the spring, the plan is to use the Pisces for the spring survey, and there's a wet lab overhaul planned for the Pisces this winter to get it ready for that, and that everything there appears to be on track, so that's good. The ecosystem monitoring survey sailed as well over the shutdown from October 18th to November 7th, completing 106 of their 187 planned stations. Weather, as you know, wasn't great, so that really affected both of those surveys. The Gulf of Maine bottom longline survey, cooperative research study, cooperative survey was completed a couple weeks ago on November 21st, and they were able to complete 100% of their planned stations. And they used a new electronic data collection system with tablets to collect the data that should improve efficiency, and that all worked well. And just want to express publicly, you know, appreciation for the many science staff who participated in those surveys, the OMEO staff, shoreside support. It was a tough time. Northeast Trawl Advisory Panel, Dan, I think, already hit the highlights there. So I'll move on from that. Cooperative research, just a reminder, that the Northeast Cooperative Research Summit scheduled for February 26th in Riverhead, New York. Registration just closed last weekend, and they're at capacity, which is good. That should be a great event, as they always are. The Observer Program, I think you all remember that the biological port sampling program transitioned from the regional office to the Science Center this year. So that contract, the combined contract, was awarded for port sampling and the Observer Program contract together. And that implementation of those two together started on October 1st. So that was really supported by intermittent federal staff and contractors pulling that forward. So that's moving, and they're looking to continue to build efficiencies to get to that as we go forward. The Observer Program's on track with coverage targets for NEFOP, ASM, and industry-funded SCALLOP, you know, 64 to 85% of the coverage targets so far. Assessment-wise, you're all aware that the September management track was completed, and we expedited the turnaround of the peer review panel report to get that to folks. PopDi staff that were involved worked feverishly to get everything ready for what at the time was a possible shutdown, to get as much as they could to council staff to then carry forward, and worked closely with council staff to try to prepare them as best we could. And many thanks to council staff who then took that information and moved things forward. That was a lot of work for you all, and my folks appreciate your efforts on their behalf. So thank you for that. And then as soon as we got back, several people got pulled into turning around some analytical products to support management measures that are ongoing. Moving to protected species, so the right whale surveys also continued over the shutdown. The center surveys, plus there's five or six collaborative groups that are also flying surveys, and ship-based surveys and acoustic receivers looking for presence of right whales. All that continued through the shutdown, so many thanks to all those folks that were involved. The Science Center aerial surveys were operating in the Gulf of St. Lawrence, and they identified 70 right whales up there in October. The winter calving season for right whales is approaching, and surveys have begun in the southeast region, and they've spotted at least six right whales so far along the North Carolina coast. So that's right whales. On-demand gear, there was a ropeless consortium meeting in October that our federal staff couldn't attend, but they pre-recorded presentations and sent those. So everyone was trying to do what they could, and our contract staff were able to attend. And their on-demand group is preparing for another experimental fishery in the Atlantic large whale take reduction plan, lobster fishing restricted areas, to start next year. With respect to marine energy development stuff, the Northeast Center survey mitigation program effort is in the final stages of editing prior to release for comments, and it appears that multiple developers are considering supporting that work to meet their survey mitigation conditions in their COP approvals, so hopefully that works out. And on the sort of ecosystem side of things and risk side of things, which might come up later, we're working with both councils to ensure that the Science Center's state of the ecosystem and ecosystem and socioeconomic profiles, that those products are integrating well with the Mid-Atlantic Council's risk policy and the Mid-Atlantic Council's risk assessment. So that work is underway. We're all working together on that. And for the state of the ecosystem reports, the plan is to produce those on the normal schedule. It may be slightly reduced what's included. And that's what I've got on the science side for the last month or two.
Thank you, Dr. Simpkins. I have a quick question related to the survey. Do you know which area they are currently working in now?
I do not know offhand where they are right now.
Okay. It would be helpful to understand what areas were low sampled and kind of getting that, where that fill-in is. And I guess my other question would be related to a December time period. Have we had surveys that have occurred in the December time period before?
Yeah, we've extended into December in the past. I don't know which years, but fluidity with the survey has happened before.
Thank you. Other questions? Jackie O'Dell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Dr. Simpkins, for the update on where we're at with science. I know you didn't present this today, but maybe we can have a discussion about this in January at our council meeting, where the management, the peer review and the management track that's coming at us for groundfish from September is again flagging aging as being a concern with a lot of the groundfish stocks that were assessed, notably redfish and white hake. I realize that there have been a number of staff that have left the Science Center and the aging, the growth and age lab. We heard an update prior to at a former council meeting that we had that the agency was Science Center was working on a plan for the continuation of portside sampling and new programs to move forward with. And again, it doesn't have to be today if there isn't an update on aging, but it seems that it's a continuing problem that we've discussed as a council. It's impacting our assessments greatly, the age-based assessments as well as the new WAM-like assessments, and it's going to impact the management discussion that we have as managers throughout the week as well as moving forward. So it would be really great to know what the plan is on aging as well. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Good points. Thanks for raising, and we share the concerns, and happy to go back and see what could be pulled together for January in terms of those things. I mean, there's the sampling issue, there's the aging, there's like it's a bunch of pieces pulled together there that
Further questions for Dr. Simpkins? Seeing none. Ms. O'Dell.
I was going to ask this during the white hake discussion, but just for clarification, the shrimp survey ended in 2023-2024. Is that correct? Just curious when the deadline, when that we were provided an update on the survey for shrimp and that it was going to be ending and those monies were going to be used elsewhere. I'm just curious when that end date was for that survey. If you know, Mike, if you don't, that's okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't know offhand. It's in the last couple of years is when it stopped. So I can try to look, or maybe someone down the table knows the answer.
We should be able to find that out for you. Further questions for Dr. Simpkins? Thank you, Dr. Simpkins. On to the Mid-Atlantic Council Liaison Report from Mr. Platts.
All right. This is the first time doing this, and I didn't take any notes in real time, so lesson to self. Take notes in real time next time, but thankfully Sherry provided me with a Mid-Atlantic review of the meeting, so I'll just kind of buzz over it. So the Mid-Atlantic on the omnibus alternative gear marking voted in sync with us to support that action, delaying the final action on the framework. Spiny dogfish Jason is here and going to be dealing with that. So I think, you know, avoiding redundancy, I'll just pass over dogfish and leave it to Jason. Monkfish, we approved measures consistent with the NEFMC. And mackerel, there have been improving recruitment in 22 and 23 and a large recruitment event in 24. Unfortunately, the preceding terminal recruitment years, 26, 16, 19, and 22, were revised down by 30%, 62, and 23%, respectively. Final action for the Mid-Atlantic Council on that will be occurring in December. So I'll be able to update you at our next meeting. And last was essential fish habitat, where the Mid-Atlantic Council proposing revisions to EFH designations for 14 of the council's managed species. So I'll provide ongoing updates for that as well.
Thank you, Mr. Platts.
And I will take notes as the meeting goes on next time.
Understandable. And it first time, yeah, rookie mistake, but we get you. Ms. Griffin.
Thank you, Chair. I thought I'd just add a little bit on mackerel, having served on the committee there. And so the committee is forwarding three motions to the Mid-Atlantic Council. One is recommending specifications be based on 60% probability of rebuilding. The other is then you're looking at trip limit and trigger of the incidental limit changes for the commercial fishery. There is looking to be an increase there based on tiering, to allow for higher trip limits. I won't try to go through those tiers right now, but it's in the document if you want to go see there. And on the recreational side, we're currently at 20 fish. There was the committee is recommending an incremental increase across the board for private and for hire to 25 fish.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Platts for Mid-Atlantic report? Jeff Kalin online.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, Melanie. I just wanted to mention that on mackerel, over the last 3 or 4 days, we've been going back and forth with Jason because the outcome the other day was this issue never came up. Tier one was proportionally reduced, but tiers two and three were not proportionally reduced. And we're working with Jason right now in a letter to come to the council before for the briefing book tomorrow with some options to review the tier two and three trip limit values that were approved by the committee last week. So just an FYI that we're working on that right now. Thank you.
Mr. Pierdnock.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a few questions. The first one has to do with Atlantic mackerel. Melanie, as you noted, there was a proposed increase to 20 to 25. The private anglers have been comfortable with the 20 based upon, past historical, public comment. There is a certain segment of the for-hire fleet that has lost clientele, those that are more at the lower end of the economic ladder, which would go on the vessel and catch plenty of mackerel and eat them, would hope that there would be some consideration for mode management, since the public in the past, the private recreational anglers, been comfortable with 20, and whether they could stay at 20 and there could be some accommodation through mode management for the for-hire fleet. Was that discussed? Was that looked at? I know that there was public comment provided, requesting that such be addressed. That's one question. Thank you.
Ms. Griffin.
Yeah, the committee, there is an alternative in the document for the split mode. I'll just note that consistent with the discussion, what was that, 2021, when we first were talking about the recreational limit, the three states in New England, Maine, New Hampshire, and Mass went on record that they don't support the split mode. So that's where that was coming from, that in terms of enforcement administration, just generally the states don't support the split mode. But there is an alternative in the document.
Thank you, Melanie. I would just request that be taken into consideration, because there have been trips lost because those clientele don't no longer go on the trips that have impacted the for-hire fleet. Also, there any update in the sector separation as well as the recreational summer flounder, black sea bass, scup, and bluefish measures?
Can't really answer that question. I was put on the council to decide to make me the Mid-Atlantic liaison, but they decided not to give me any Mid-Atlantic committees. It's kind of baffling position to be in, and is pretty well explains why Melanie's answering your other questions. I'll leave it at that. I've raised the issue, and it doesn't make any sense to me. Puts me in an awkward position to be reporting on committees on which I'm not assigned. That's a reality right now.
Jason Dinn.
Yeah, I'm not directly involved in the sector separation, but I'll just note at our December meeting on the kind of draft lists, the recreational sector separation amendment is on there. Review and provide guidance on revised draft alternatives, and it's with the commission's policy board. So continuing to churn. And there was another part of that. Was it rec measures? Garfo might know kind of where that stands in the process, but I'm not sure.
Mr. Pitney.
So there's two pieces to Summer Flounder Scup and sea bass management. The overall specifications, we typically have a proposed rule out by this point with an expectation of a final rule before the end of the calendar year for next year. The proposed rule is, unfortunately, in a similar place to where the herring final rule was. It's being held up at headquarters, so I don't know when that's going to publish. But the recreational measures setting process that the council and the commission undertakes will be next in 2 weeks at that meeting, December meeting, leading into rulemaking in the spring of 2026.
Brief follow-up.
Yeah, thank you, Mike. Just one, and Jason, just one last thing. There will also be a sector separation. Will that be discussed at the meeting in December? Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Yes, that's on the agenda as well.
Thank you for that clarity. Appreciate it.
Moving on. ASMFC report, Mr. Beal.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ted, I've got 33 pages of notes, so I'll make up for it and hopefully not read all these and bore everybody to death. But just going through a couple species, hitting the highlights from the commission's annual meeting that took place the last week of October. The Atlantic Herring Management Board got together and they distributed the sub-ACL for Area 1A throughout the year of 2026. And what they agreed to was no landings before June 1st. About 73% of the quota would be available from June 1st through the end of September, and the remaining 27% would be available in October, November, and December, similar to the current year. The Gulf of Maine states will get together and have days out meetings starting in the spring to determine what the days out will be for the June through September, and then as the year goes along through the October through December seasons for that fishery. So pretty similar distribution of that quota for Atlantic herring for 2026 as it was this year. The American Lobster Board got together and reviewed or received the results of a new benchmark stock assessment for American lobster. Some of the key takeaways there was that the landings or the biomass in the Gulf of Maine has dropped about 34% from 2018 through the current estimate. So, you know, that's a fairly significant drop and concerning to the scientists. The other takeaway for the Gulf of Maine stock was that the stock is experiencing overfishing now. The stock assessment folks, you know, noted that the fishery has been close to the overfishing threshold for quite a while, and it just barely went over that in this benchmark assessment. They felt that, you know, it's noteworthy. However, you know, they felt that the point estimate wasn't quite as important as the trend, which is the fishing mortality rate is ticking up a little bit. It wasn't a drastic change in fishing mortality. It just went across that threshold, so it makes it look like or sounds very different than what it was previously. But it's pretty close as far as fishing mortality rate to where it was. So the Gulf of Maine states in particular are going to meet with their industry, continue to meet with their industry and talk about the results of the assessment and, engage with the industry to see what they feel is an appropriate course forward. And then the commission will continue to work with the states and work on updating the management program for this fishery as necessary. The Southern New England stock was still in rough shape for American lobster, depleted, however, it's not experiencing overfishing. The fishing mortality that happens in Southern New England is very low, but however, you know, that stock is less than, or the harvest from that Southern New England stock is less than 2% of the entire coastwide harvest, so it's a relatively small component of the overall lobster fishery. The Atlantic Herring Board met as well, and received benchmark stock assessment results and a benchmark single species assessment for menhaden and a benchmark stock assessment for the ecological reference point work that the commission does that takes into account the ecological role of menhaden as a predator, as a prey species for many of the predators, fish and birds and whales and others. And based on the change in the natural mortality rate, the status of that stock changed pretty significantly. And the quota projections moving forward indicated that a 54% cut in the menhaden quota was needed to maintain a 50% chance of not exceeding the fishing mortality target. So the board heard this information, and there was a lot of public interest, a lot of public at the meeting. And ultimately, after a lengthy discussion, the board decided to take a 20% reduction in the quota for 2026. They did not set quotas for 27 and 28, which they had the ability to do, and they want to go back and look at some of the socioeconomic information to determine the economic impacts of changing the quota potentially is, at that drastic of a level. So, that's a ongoing work for menhaden. So kind of stay tuned, and the board will get back together at our annual meeting in October of 2026 here in Newport, Rhode Island, to set the quotas for 2027 and beyond. So stay tuned on menhaden management. It's a pretty significant change for 2026 already. And then the last species that's of interest to this corner of the world is Atlantic striped bass. The board was considering a 12% reduction in harvest for Atlantic striped bass and decided to maintain status quo and for 2026. And that decision was based on the fishing mortality rate being at the lowest level that we've had in decades. It's the commission's cut that fishery way back already through the states. And they also, felt that the big problem and the longer term problem with this stock is a lack of recruitment. The recruitment for the last 7 years has been very poor, almost non-existent in the Chesapeake region. So they put together a working group, and there's also a benchmark stock assessment that's being completed in 2027. And the working group's going to look at sort of longer term management of this stock. The goal right now is to fully rebuild the stock by 2029. We're pretty close to on track to do that. The preliminary landings in 2025 were relatively low, and that was another reason the board maintained status quo for 2026. So another stock, kind of stay tuned, and there's going to be a lot more talk and consideration about where the commission should go longer term on striped bass. It's a, it's a difficult stock to manage when you don't have any recruitment. So, there's some pockets of really good fishing right now up and down the East Coast, but there are a lot of areas that aren't seeing any fish or very reduced fishing compared to historic levels. So those are the activities or the highlights anyway that happened at our annual meeting. One thing to note is the Northern Shrimp Section and Advisory Panel are meeting in Portland, Maine on December 11th, and they're going to go over the pilot industry-based survey work that was done, or the data collection program, the what we call our traffic light indicators, which is a series of indicators for how well that stock is doing, and then they're going to set the specifications for 2026. If you're in Portland on December 11th, you can swing by the Northern Shrimp meeting. They'd love to have you. So happy to answer any questions on that. The commission took up a lot of other business at the annual meeting, but I didn't want to go through all the details in interest of time, but happy to answer any questions if I can.
Thank you, Mr. Beal. Ted, your hand's up. Is this related to ASMFC? Terry Alexander.
Yeah, is there any potential for a shrimp season this year, Bob? I'm not aware of anyone.
No, I smart money's on no.
Yeah.
The survey work that the industry did wasn't extremely successful. Didn't catch a lot of shrimp. So I don't, there was some hope that they'd be able to find some pockets of shrimp, but they weren't able to do that, is my understanding.
So it's just a scientific meeting then, basically, when they meet in December.
Yeah, well, review all the science that's available and see if there's or think about the direction of that fishery longer term.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. Pierdnock. then Jeff Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Bob. Just a few questions. I mean, with lobster, you noted the downward trend in Gulf of Maine, and you know it's evident in southern New England, where that trend has continued downward. As one looks at the fact that black sea bass and tog, for example, their range has expanded and they moved into these different areas. Has that been considered as far as the mortality that's driving this downward trend that from a ecosystem standpoint? Because I speak to the lobster fleet, and they're all complaining about them in their traps, and yet we have disconnects with seasons and bag limits that we'd like to see increase with some of these species, and maybe that'd be the mechanism to try to address it.
Yeah, the assessment focused more on water temperature and other conditions that may be affecting the reproductive capacity of the lobster rather than the predation from black sea bass and tog, is my understanding. So, you know, they haven't worked into that stock assessment, the predation by those animals. But, you know, for example, black sea bass quota, if the specs are available to be published, that, you know, that quota may be going up this year. So there may be some good news for black sea bass quotas and other things. But yeah, we, you know, we understand, we hear the same thing for industry, that there are, you know, those critters being caught in their traps, and the predation is something they're concerned about in the Gulf of Maine.
Well, thank you. I encourage you to please look at that. And you noted with the menhaden, with a 54% to 20% reduction, and if I understand this properly, it's considered a critical forage for striped bass, and there's a set aside for that. I heard some, I don't know if it was rumors or what, but is bluefin something that's going to be considered in the future as that being critical forage, which once again we all know that it is, and the studies have shown by the University of Maine and Walt Gollett's work that there's more menhaden being, you know, found in the bellies of bluefin than in the old days. So is that something that's going to be considered in the future, number one? And then number two, with your striped bass work group, what's the criteria, or, you know, what will be the makeup of that, and how will that be determined? Thanks.
Yeah, I'll take those in the reverse order. The motion that was passed that set up the working group, you know, included a pretty broad group of people that could potentially be on that working group. It hasn't been set yet. We're trying to right now parse out, you know, what work is that working group going to tackle. There's some work that will be addressed through the benchmark stock assessment that's coming up. There's some independent work through the socioeconomic committee at ASMFC, and then we're kind of trying to figure out, all right, what's left over after that benchmark and our socioeconomic group is done, and that's what the work group will focus on. So based on that sort of list of the to-do list, then we're going to, the leadership of the board and the commission will get together and then select the membership of that working group. So it's pretty open-ended right now, and anyone can be on, you know, the range of available people is wide open, is the best way to put it. And then as far as bluefin tuna goes, the ecological reference point model is, you know, they have considered bluefin tuna. I don't think it's fully integrated in that model yet. One of the things that the way that the ecological reference point model works is it takes striped bass. It's probably one of the most sensitive species for menhaden abundance, and essentially says, well, if there's enough menhaden to satisfy the predatory needs of striped bass, then a lot of these other species are probably accommodated as well. So if we can keep the biomass of menhaden available along the coast at high enough levels for striped bass, there should be enough menhaden for bluefin tuna and osprey and all these other species that are of concern to folks. So, but that working group is still considering modifying that ecological reference point model to include other species, and bluefin tuna and whales and others are being considered for that.
Mr. Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Bob, thanks for the update. I had a follow-up question on the striped bass situation. So I think I understood you to say that the plan is to rebuild by 2029 and that you are on track to do so. And you also said there's very poor recruitment across much of the range. And I'm trying in my brain to resolve how you're getting the rebuilding progress with poor recruitment, if there's a simple answer to that.
Yeah, the simple answer is the fish that are in the system now are growing. So the biomass of the individual fish that are in the population right now are getting bigger as they get older. There's not a lot of new fish entering the population. So, you know, there's a very real chance that the commission can, you know, meet that rebuilding timeline of 2029 and have the stock fully rebuilt and, you know, sort of send out a press release, hey, good news, fully rebuilt. But then right after that, based on the poor recruitment, you know, the stock may start tailing off because there's no new fish entering the population. So that's the big concern is longer term, you know, meeting the 2029 goal is important, but really longer term, what, you know, what's a realistic way to manage the stock? What is, you know, what's the biomass that can be maintained if we are in a new low recruitment sort of stanza is what the assessment folks are calling it. So we'll keep working on it and see what can be done.
Yeah, thanks for that. And if I could just also a quick one on the Menhaden situation. So I appreciate your explanation of what transpired with that discussion and how the ecological reference points are supposed to work and being updated. And I'm curious how it's a little unclear to me how the ecological reference point management portion of it works. I know you have targets and you have limits, I think, and there's a range there, and the advice was to have a 50% cut to stay within the target, and there was some room there between the target and the limit. So how does the ASMFC navigate the range between the ecological reference points targets and the limits?
Yeah, up until now, the board has set quotas that have a very high probability of achieving the fishing mortality target, so the higher or more restrictive target, if you want to call it that. But, you know, with this new information, the board noted that you know, there's a lot of room to operate and still be between the target and threshold. You know, there's even with the 20% cut, which is not the 54% cut, there's still very little chance of, I think it's 0% chance, actually, of going below the or exceeding the threshold. In other words, having overfishing actually occurring for next year. So the board noted there is a lot of room to work within that, between the target and threshold, and that are set through the ecological reference point work. So I think that's part of this discussion moving forward. You know, we've been somewhat conservative in that, you know, we're shooting for the target and having at least a 50% chance of achieving that target. And, you know, is the board willing to take more risk than they have in the past is one of the questions they'll be faced with.
Thank you, Mr. Beal. Sounds like you guys got a lot on your plate. Finally, you, not us, but great. Moving on to our Coast Guard report in our obstructed view seats there, Lieutenant Blyfus, when you're ready. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this is a Coast Guard District Northeast report to Council. Wait for slides to pull up. All right, next slide, please. Since September 2025, Coast Guard's conducted 71 fishing vessel boardings, issued 9 violations for an observed compliance rate of 89%. The violations issued were 4 documentation-related, 1 reporting/notifications, 3 VMS violations, and 1 species or area. From the safety side, conducted 125 dockside exams with 107 safety decals issued. Again, 71 boardings with 16 safety violations issued on board 9 individual vessels, 1 commercial fishing vessel safety termination, and 89% observed compliance rate. Most common safety violations issued during this time, 3 EPIRB-related, 4 survival craft, 4 flares, 3 firefighting-related, and 2 related to documentation, numbering, placards, or drills. And for search and rescue, responded to 70 fishing vessel incidents or casualties, to include 2 disabled fishing vessels, 1 elision, 6 vessels aground or taking on water / lost on rocks, 11 lives saved, and 1 medevac medico. Pending any questions, that concludes my report.
Questions for Lieutenant Blyfus? Seeing none, thank you very much. On to the NOAA OLE report, Caleb Gilbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. Morning, Council members. Compliance liaison Caleb Gilbert, NOAA Fisheries Office of Law Enforcement. A couple of details I'd like to share with the Council today. Like many in the room, we're grateful the shutdown ended, but for us it was largely business as usual. For those unaware, OLE staff were listed as accepted in the last shutdown, so considered essential. It's most likely all OLE staff will be categorized similarly in the future, any future shutdowns should they occur. First, I'll just say that we're in the process of updating our FY 2026 regional priorities. Hopefully, I'll be able to provide an update on those priorities to the council at the January meeting. Our enforcement of all the laws in our portfolio will continue, and we will continue to prioritize enforcement of our domestic fisheries laws. Next, cover a little bit of our trade enforcement work since the June meeting. Since the September meeting. In FY 2025, OLE in the Northeast Division conducted a total of 92 trade monitoring patrols or operations. That was between October 1st, 2024 and September 30th, 2025. We conducted 12 so far in the current fiscal year 2026, since October 1st. More specifically, following a joint OLE-U.S. Customs Border Patrol seafood import monitoring program focused patrol, that's kind of a mouthful, in a New Jersey-based East Coast warehouse involving two of our D2 enforcement officers last September. A summary settlement was issued to an international fisheries trade permit holder for failing to declare grouper in their required SIMP reporting. More recently, October 16th and 17th, two of our D2 enforcement officers collaborated with New Jersey Fish and Wildlife State and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, FDA, and USCBP federal law enforcement partners on what we called Operation Tuna Melt. Investigating officers collected 16 samples of frozen tuna on the first day at the Port Liberty container facility in New York, and 12 samples on the second day, October 17th, at a similar container facility in northern New Jersey. All samples were taken for species analysis using one of our newer acquired rapid high precision portable DNA testing devices. All related investigations are ongoing. Moving on to our enforcement in support of North Atlantic right whale conservation. On October 5th, a Division II enforcement officer alongside New Jersey JEA, Joint Enforcement Agreement, or state officers, conducted an at-sea patrol of coastal waters off New Jersey up to 30 miles offshore and hauled 5 lobster trawls with no Atlantic large whale take reduction plan violations identified. Regarding our related or Atlantic large whale take reduction plan quarterly compliance metrics, I can report out for the third quarter FY 2025. So between April 1st and June 30th of this year, OLE and state enforcement partners combined to conduct a total of 59 take reduction plan focused patrol days involving both our D1 and D2, so all of Northeast Division enforcement partners. As always, Maine Marine Patrol Enforcement conducted the majority of these patrols, but in the third quarter, we documented patrols conducted independently by Mass Environmental Police, New Hampshire Fish and Game, Maryland Natural Resource Police, and New York Department of Environmental Conservation. And that's in addition to the OLE contract platform vessel patrols that we conducted. Cumulatively, in the third quarter, FY25, OLE and enforcement partners collectively inspected trawls from 314 vessels on separate take reduction plan focused patrol days. Our patrolling officers identified take reduction plan violations on 57 of those vessels whose gear was inspected on a particular patrol. That's at an approximately 82% compliance rate. And I'm still catching up on tabulating our take reduction compliance rate and patrol metrics for the fourth quarter FY25. Should have that available to the council at the January meeting. Regarding the speed rule enforcement prong of our North Atlantic right whale conservation efforts, in early September, two NOVA penalties were paid for speed rule cases, both involving recreational pleasure vessels, one vessel based out of New York and the other from Florida.
Then in late September, a charter headboat owner based out of New York paid a NOVA penalty for a speed rule case that began as a New York State JEA referral. Moving on to our enforcement efforts in support of the Observer program. In early October, a vessel on a squid trip off New York was updated to 5-minute ping rates in response to a report received of a vessel with a fire on board that also had an observer. The issue was resolved without further incident. The 5-minute ping rate was turned off before the trip concluded. In addition, our Observer program liaison special agent provided enforcement training to a new training class of observers for the October 2025 at-sea monitor training and participated in the accompanying observer support panel that occurs at those events alongside Science Center's FMO division and U.S. Coast Guard representatives. Another highlight I thought might be worth mentioning to the council today is that on September 4th, two D2 enforcement officers traveled to Elizabeth City, U.S. Coast Guard's D5 air station to discuss collaboration related to living marine resource patrols utilizing fixed and rotary wing patrols. Or aircraft, and a specific discussion involved joint U.S. Coast Guard D5 and OLE interest in utilizing U.S. Coast Guard aerial assets to identify IUU fishing vessels in the EEZ, enforcement of our North Atlantic right whale SMA regulations, so the seasonal management area or speed rule regulations, and to conduct patrols of the Lautenberg deep sea coral protection area. And on a related follow-up patrol, one of our D2 EOs patrolled the Lautenberg Deep Sea Coral Protection Area on a C-130 out of the U.S. Coast Guard Air Station Elizabeth City on October 22nd. Targets on that patrol were draggers transiting the area out, as well as swordfish vessels participating in an ongoing tournament with the intent to review landing reports later. That October 22 patrol was one of two air patrols on board U.S. Coast Guard assets our enforcement officers have participated in so far in FY 2026. The other was out of U.S. Coast Guard Station Cape Cod patrolling in the D1 AOR. And we only participated actually in one air patrol all year in FY 2025. The last details I'll mention today to the council are land and sea patrol totals for FY 2025. So since October 1st, 2024 through September 30 this year, our FY25 land patrol totals included 309 patrols. We've conducted actually 65 since the start of the current FY2026, October 1st. And we also conducted 111 at-sea patrols in FY25, 16 so far this FY. Those land and at-sea patrol stats include patrols focused on our domestic fisheries law enforcement priorities, such as highly migratory species, scallop, Atlantic large whale take reduction plan, et cetera. And last, I'll just regarding TOG's response earlier, I just wanted to let you know that I hear you. My recollection of the conversations that we had is that they're kind of inherent logistical issues surrounding our ability to provide the data that the council and the committee had requested. And just one thought I had off the top of my head, I know I've mentioned to the council in the past that we're interested in revising the written reports that we provide to the council. I don't know what it would look like or how it would be tabulated, but maybe that's an avenue to help provide the council with ad hoc or routine information that might be of more use than maybe what we've provided in the past. But that concludes my report, Mr. Chairman. I'm happy to take any questions if folks have them.
Thank you, Mr. Gilbert. Any questions for the OLE report? Tog Braun.
Not a question, but just a comment. I want to say thank you, and it seemed to me like there must have been some sort of a disconnect there. So anything that we can do to work together to get this, we all know everyone's working hard, and it was, I don't want anyone to perceive that we're saying, geez, what the hell happened there? It was, even though that sort of was in a way, the way it came off. It's really important that we make sure everyone's working together, and I appreciate your bringing that up and looking forward to working with you in the future.
My pleasure, Tog.
Thank you, Ms. Braun. Thank you, Mr. Gilbert. Up next is our NAFO report, Jeff Smith.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Northwest Atlantic Fisheries Organization held its 47th annual meeting in Halifax, Nova Scotia from September 15th to 18th of this year. The U.S. was represented by our three NAFO commissioners, which are myself, Mike Pentney, and our former chairman, Eric Reed, and several staff from NOAA, the Science Center, and the State Department. The delegation was also joined by Dr. Eric Noble, the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary for Oceans and Atmosphere at NOAA, for the second half of the meeting. This meeting was the first one where NAFO applied its new precautionary approach framework to fisheries management. They adopted that one last year, and this framework is designed to ensure NAFO continues to lead with sustainability-focused fisheries management backed by sound science. So it was under this new framework that we spent much of the week discussing annual catch limits for the dozen or so species that NAFO manages, and I just wanted to touch on a couple of the other key priority issues for the U.S. delegation during the week. The highest priority issue for us was working to make changes to the definition of directed fishing in the current NAFO regulatory context. That current definition is quite restrictive, and it creates situations where a captain can make one bad tow early in a trip and subsequently be found out of compliance with rules that prohibit directed fishing on species that are under a catch moratoria. This is a situation that has happened to several U.S. vessels in the past, and one that we spent a lot of time that week trying to address. We did make substantial progress on resolving those issues at the meeting, and I think by introducing a formal proposal to change the definition, we prompted some pretty meaningful discussions amongst all the contracting parties, and have also recruited several allies, contracting parties, to help us continue to work on that definition in advance of next year's annual meeting. We also made some good progress on forming a coalition with some other NAFO contracting parties, including Norway, Iceland, Japan, and the United Kingdom that, like the United States, has relatively low allocations of some key NAFO-managed stocks. We agreed to work intersessionally to discuss some collective approaches that potentially can lead to us reopening the quota key and getting some more access to some of the stocks that we have not had much access to in the past. Other than that, we did some work with Canada. We successfully brokered a management arrangement between the U.S. and Canada to trade 40 tons of U.S. northern cod for 250 tons of Canadian yellowtail flounder quota to provide some additional opportunity for U.S. fishermen. And lastly, we initiated a discussion with Canada regarding a potential bilateral agreement on halibut and yellowtail flounder with the goal of reaching some beneficially mutual outcomes for both the U.S. and Canada industries. So we'll be talking with them more this fall and before next year's meeting. And finally, at the end of the meeting, NAFO elected Joost Paardekooper from the EU as its new chairperson. The election of the new chair was needed because the current chair, the chair for the last meeting, Deirdre Warner-Kramer of the U.S., is retiring in January. And I just wanted to take a quick minute to personally thank Deirdre for her decades of service at the State Department and more recently as the chair of the NAFO Commission over the past several years. Deirdre really did an amazing job of navigating the many challenges at NAFO and always did so with an even hand and a firm grasp of the issues. And she was always just really fair and made sure that everybody's voices in the room was able to be heard. So she was a true master of diplomacy, in my opinion, and she will be missed. And I wish her the best of luck in her retirement. That concludes my report, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Quist. Mr. Smith. Any questions for Jeff? Seeing none. Moving on to our last report of the day, Mr. Piernock, ICAP.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll give you the short version because I'm sure you're all hungry. I was part of the U.S. delegation at ICAT, their annual meeting in Sevilla, Spain, November 15th to the 24th. I'll just provide you a little bit of details about ICAT and then get into the specific details of some of the decisions that were made. ICAT, the International Commission on Conservation of Atlantic Tunas, manages pelagics, marlin, swordfish, tunas, the tropical tunas, the bluefins, sharks, and so on, that transverse across multiple boundaries, multiple countries. Via a treaty called the Atlantic Tuna Convention Act, by law, by that treaty, we are to abide by the decisions of ICAT. And ultimately, when it comes back here to the United States, it must also comply with the Magnuson-Stevens Act. So there's a double-edged sword to that. This year, we're up to 55 contracting parties or countries. Cuba and Montenegro have been added to the list. Actually, there's more than that because the EU represents one seat at the table where they have 20-some different countries. The way it operates is it's a consensus vote, and on rare occasions there have been those items that have come to the floor to where it's actually been voted upon. But typically, decisions are made by consensus. One thing I'd like to thank is, or just note that for me, these were nonstop from the 15th to the 24th, 14 to 16-hour days. We would be in session from 9 to 6 o'clock each day, and you'd have breaks for coffee and lunch, but we'd have delegation meetings prior to at lunchtime and afterwards that went long into the night. The NOAA employees and the National Marine Fisheries Service and all of those that were at the table should be commended, because when I went to sleep after 14, 16 hours, they were still up. And they were writing, the proposals and discussing them and having negotiations with others and then getting each proposal translate into French, Spanish, or Arabic. So they are a dedicated group of individuals that it impressed the hell out of me to see their work ethic and their professionalism. So I just want to note that. Now, there's supposed to be a U.S. announcement going out, an ICAT announcement going out that is yet to hit the airwaves, but I can provide you a few little details here of the main thing, which was bluefin tuna. Bluefin was major issue this year, and to note here, the U.S. delegation is returned home with more bluefin tuna quota for the U.S. fishermen. It represents a 17% quota increase, but fell short of what the U.S. fought for. This increase was acquired despite a management procedure developed from the bluefin MSC that called for a decrease in western bluefin tuna attack, thereby reducing the U.S. quota share. Most of the ICAT nations supported the BR management procedure, which would have decreased the U.S. quota drawn from the Western Atlantic TAC while increasing the Eastern Atlantic TAC. The increase is based on the best scientific information available. The U.S. balanced the commitment to increasing our domestic quota to bring relief to U.S. bluefin tuna fishermen with the close-kin recapture science that was available to support its commitment to getting more quota. While the Western TAC increase provided the U.S. with the largest quota increase in years, the U.S. fought for more but ultimately was restrained by the MSC in place for bluefin tuna. This infusion of more available fish will provide tangible benefits to U.S. fishermen for 2026 and thereafter. Beyond that, the U.S. has made it clear that the fight for equitable distribution of bluefin allocation will continue, including an upcoming ICAT intersessional meeting scheduled for March 26. So there was a few other things in addition for bluefin. Some of these, I mean, here in the U.S. we already do address, but they made a no retention, no transshipping of great white sharks and basking sharks that must be released if captured or caught, excuse me. Mako continues at a no retention of 1,000-ton mortality cap for all countries. ICAT also adopted some formal management procedures for skipjack with a fixed tack of 30,844 metric tons from 2026 to 2028. There were some enforcement issues that were implemented, tougher port state measures aimed at stopping illegal, unreported, unregulated fishing, an expanded authorized list of commercial vessels for boats over 20 meters in size, and strengthened port inspections and vessel tracking measures that mainly impact the commercial sector. Mr. Smith noted NAFO. I perked my ears up when that was discussed at ICAT, and from what I understand, the NAFO and ICAT are working on entering into a memorandum of understanding to work together and share scientific information and data associated with each fishery that's managed by both entities. You mentioned Deidre Kramer. Yep, she retired. We're going to miss her. She's been working there for a long time, and they did have a nice send-off for her. She was the chair of since 1998, what's known as STACFAD, which is the Standing Committee of Finance and Administration. And, there was those around the table that said she's an icon. And if for those of you know ICAT, MASA from Japan is an icon, and she was put right up there with them. So that was quite an honor for her to hear that and have have such a send-off. I think that's... anyone has any questions, if you happen to answer them. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Pierre-Nock. Any questions related to the ICAT report? Seeing none, thank you for keeping that brief, Mr. Pierre-Nock. Appreciate it. The short version. So we're only about 10 minutes behind, so I still want to call everyone back at 1:30. We will get our guidance on counsel and financial disclosure and voting recusals from Attorney Scott Sikowski. So back here at 1:30. Thank you.